gonna die, clown!
Now that's what I call high quality H2O.
I'm Scuba Sam, Scuba Steve's father.
We eat the pig and then together we burn.
Well, I have a microphone and you don't.
So you will listen to every damn word I have to say!
Hello, everyone, and welcome to this latest, very special episode of the Billy Gilmore Podcast, the podcast for the discerning Adam Sandler fan, the pod for the fan of the Sandman. I am your host, Wilson Smith, and joining me as always...
Hi, this is Chris Giles.
And Austin Colt.
And tonight we have a very, very, very special episode of the Billy Gilmore Podcast. As promised, we are departing by necessity. We are done with Sandler's films for now, and so we are departing for the wild territory of the rest of the Happy Madison gang. We're going to be covering all those folks with all the detail and you know, rigor that you expect from the Billy Gilmore show. But first, before we dive into all this, I want to welcome our very special guest tonight. He's joining the pod, not for the first time, but tonight with us, we've got Brian Cobb. Say hey, Brian.
Hey, thanks for having me back, Wilson.
So glad to have you back, man. Of course, if you weren't around for the week of episode, and apparently I wasn't because I forgot and had to re-ask before the recording. If you weren't here for that episode, Brian, we go way back. We used to, you know, we were video store employees at the fabled Vulcan Video, which is the genesis for this entire podcast, more or less. And we've, you know, Brian's a great writer. He and I have written together. Just all around good guy. You know, knowledgeable, knows a ton about film, knows something about weed. I don't know. we can edit that out. Anyways, so we're very happy to have you, Brian. So tonight we are, of course, as I believe we promised last time, before we get into the sort of chronological, we do want to take this exploration of the periphery of Adam Sandler's cinematic universe. We do want to take this chronologically, and we do want to do it a little bit like structurally correct. But this episode we thought would be a great sort of intro transition into that world. And of course, the movie we are covering tonight is 2006's Grandma's Boy, directed by Nicholas Goosen. And starring Alan Covert. Very excited to be covering this. This is a big one. It's, you know, this isn't like, you know, when we talk about Bucky Larson, Born to Be a Star, I don't know what, you know, I don't know how many people will care to hear about that one, but Grandma's Boy, quite a cult following in the 16 years since it's been, since it was released. So we're going to dive into all of that. But first, I guess we'll cover just a tiny little bit of Sandler news, just to keep everyone updated as to where this recording is happening. We recently, I guess this week or last week, got a trailer for his new film, Hustle, which full disclosure, I did not actually watch the trailer because I know I'm going to watch this movie. And so I was like, you know, since it's a Netflix movie, it's not like I'm going to run into it in theaters, or like, it's not like I'm going to be forced to watch it like while seeing something else at the theater. So I was just like, you know what? I'll just be surprised by everything. I did see the screen caps going around saying from Adam Sandler and LeBron James, which sort of made it seem like LeBron James wrote it with Adam Sandler, which, as excited as I am for the movie, that would be much more exciting if that was the case. Did y'all see the trailer? What'd y'all think?
I don't care about basketball at all, but the trailer still pulled me in, so I'm going to be there.
Yeah, I did watch this trailer. It does feel somewhat familiar to me in that sense of like having just these elements of like, well, there's this guy who's going to like just take a star through this. Through the sport, but yeah, it definitely felt, I don't know if I quite got any like major humor notes in it that it feels like it's not going to be a Happy Madison-esque movie, although it is Happy Madison, maybe, I think.
Yeah, I think that's right.
Yeah. So if it's anything in that, it'll be probably closer to like his attitude in like a Longest Yard, if that makes sense, where it's like a little bit more, he was like the straight shooter style. So
this actually says, Googling it, that it's from Madison 23 Productions. And didn't we determine that that's their like boutique, that's Gabby Madison's like boutique label? Like that's their like, it's like when they want to release a classy picture, like The Piano or Crying Game.
This is their A24.
That's their A24. Yeah, I feel like there was absolutely a movie that we watched that had Madison, like Madison 23. I was like, is this what I think it is? And it was. the movie comes out June 10th. It's a Netflix movie. The reaction's been super positive. Sandler. You know, we saw this with Uncut Gems, even though that was written prior to his coming aboard. But, he's very vocally a big basketball fan. It looks like just another excuse for him to sort of bring that interest into his movies. So, yeah, excited to see it. Mark your calendars, June 10. Should be fun. Okay, we're all done marking your calendars. I think that's it. I think we should just start talking about Grandma's Boy. So this film is 2006, directed by Nicholas Goosen. It stars Alan Covert, that's where we should probably start, is Alan Covert, because this is the only Happy Madison movie. This is the only movie he has ever starred in. He appeared at, obviously, cameo appearances. He's a stalwart member of the Sandler Squad. We got him in cameo roles all over the place. He's 10 Second Tom in 50 First Dates. He's one half of the gay couple in Big Daddy. He went to NY. I guess like that's gonna be part of this new like trajectory of the show, is we're gonna have to like detail these people's origin stories like in the Sandler universe. He went to NYU with Adam Sandler. I can't remember if they were roommates or not, but he was studying theater and got hooked up with Sandler. And he goes so far back with him, like movie wise, that he's even in Going Overboard. Right. Which I know we made mention of that in that episode all those years ago, but it still bears repeating. It's like, oh, like Going Overboard, that's real Sandler Squad if you were in that with him.
Yes.
And so I had started to notice over the years his name in the credits, I guess just because I finally knew who he was, but he's produced like every single Adam Sandler, not Uncut Gems or whatever, but he's produced every single Adam Sandler movie that has come through Happy Madison, like since the founding of the company. And so he is like absolutely OG ride or die Sandler Squad. As we know, Sandler is very generous to his friends, and he was so generous that he allowed Alan Covert to take basically like a really stupid idea. Okay, well, I won't judge. No judgment calls yet. A premise based on his own experience, wherein he was forced to live with his own grandmother for 2 weeks, and like couldn't be around. He was like scared to show her that he had tattoos or whatever, and that gave him the idea for this classic comedy premise about a perpetually stoned video game designer, tester, at the ancient age of 35. basically just having to move in with his grandma and her wacky friend. It's basically like, what if a stoner had to live with the Golden Girls? I'm curious about prior to like kind of talking about the plot a little bit, I'm curious about what this movie, we're all of the age that we would have seen this movie, we would have been kind of the perfect age to see this movie when it was first released. I was 17 when it came out. I was a month away from turning 17. So I still snuck in to see it opening weekend. And I only bring that up because the movie now has quite a cult following. It's known, it's a perpetual, it sold really, really well on home video despite not doing well at the box office. And so I'm kind of curious to hear what y'all's relationship was with Grandma's Boy prior to watching it this time. I guess we'll start with our guest, Brian. What did you had? I know you had seen it beforehand, but like, what? Like, when did you see it? How many times? What did you like it? What's your take?
So I'm kind of late to the Grandma's Boy party. I only watched it in full about a couple years ago, and I caught bits and pieces on cable in the years prior because it played all the time. It just seemed like this oddity to me, starring the caddy from Happy Gilmore and Adam Sandler's friend from The Wedding Singer. But I actually liked it a whole lot, and it held up on a repeat viewing. It's definitely a time capsule of 2006, especially with a video game culture not being nearly as mainstream, and it even captures a little of the unsavory aspects of some of the gamer dweebs of that era. So it has a nostalgia for sure.
What about you, Chris? When did you, what's your relationship with this movie?
So I totally missed it when it came out in theaters. And you know, so 2006, so that would have been, you know, like the year that Click was released. And I was very much aware of Click and that it was, you know, this big movie. But I think by that point, I was kind of had fallen off the, like the Sandler train, which isn't to say that I had fallen off of like big silly comedies. Like I remember probably like around this time, one of my favorite comedies was Wedding Crashers. Like I was still very much in the pocket for this movie. I just had kind of checked out of Sandler's whole universe for a bit. So I missed it in theaters, had no idea of its existence. And my first semester at UT was actually the summer of 2006. And I remember rooming with a buddy of mine from high school, and we were friendly, but we weren't great pals. So we just kind of bonded over shared, you know, movie and video game, just like common interests. And I just remember there were like four things that were perpetually on our TV in that dorm room that summer. There was like, there was a Fight Night, like the boxing game, which is appropriate because that's what opens this movie. There was Grandma's Boy. There was the movie Waiting with Ryan Reynolds and Justin Long, and like the first two seasons of Scrubs. Like those were all that we watched every day for the 2 to 3 months that we were there, you know, starting our journey as college students. And I mean, like my memory of that time is, you know, as our memory of college times are a little like kind of hazy and probably somewhat like, you know, seen with rose tinted glasses. But like, so like, my memory is that we watched Grandma's Boy every day. More likely, maybe we watched it once a week, but that was still probably eight to 10 times we watched this thing that summer. And it's always just kind of had that sort of very just silly, up at all hours, drinking Mountain Dew, playing video games and watching Grandma's Boy. I've seen it many times since then. I remember at one point when we were working at Vulcan, putting it on one night when I was working with our good friend, Danny Benson, and just quoting the whole thing start to finish with him, and watching it now today before our show, it's just like, yeah, like this is just one of those movies, not unlike say, well, really like the first 10 years of Sandler's career where it's just committed to memory. It's just like, it's just in there. And I don't know, man, I still dig it. It's fun.
How about you, Austin?
I mean, so I don't think I saw this in theaters because I'm gonna assume that it didn't last long. I know it didn't have a huge draw. So
$6 million in theaters, yeah, which in pandemic times might be really good.
Yeah. So I mean, it looks like its opening weekend it came in at 13th. So I was same weekend as Hostel. I definitely was there. So I'm gonna guess I watched this. I know I for sure watched it. I'm going to guess this was like my senior year of high school. I'm going to guess I was working at Blockbuster that summer. I probably just rented it and don't recall it that much. Like I remember seeing it. I just don't like, it didn't, it was somewhere in a haze of like the, maybe around college, graduating high school haze. So I definitely saw it then, and I've seen bits and pieces of it. It's pretty regular Comedy Central.
Yeah. Time.
It's on quite a bit.
Yeah, that's sort of my, so like I was not a smoker in high school. And I had a good friend, I won't name him because now he's an engineer and he makes more money than I'll in a day than I'll see this year. But he was big stoner, my friend in high school. And, I wanted to see the movie because I don't know, I was just like into these sorts of like raunchy comedies at the time. And you know, being a 17 year old guy, and my buddy, I'm sorry, I'm going to like accidentally name him at some point because I keep almost saying it. My buddy, big stoner, was really excited to see it for that reason. He also loved video games, but who didn't at that age, or now. And he, we went to see it the opening weekend, Sunday matinee. And I remember he thought it was hilarious. And I was a little bit more like, sure, it has its moments, like whatever. And then you're right, it played so often on Comedy Central. And like in college, it was just like, it wasn't me, but like there was one of the roommates I had one of the years I was at college, he had like four DVDs and one of them was the unrated version of Grandma's Boy. So it just like it became sort of a staple. And although I say that, I had not seen this in like, except for like Vulcan Video screenings, I had not seen this in like a decade. Mm-hmm. This was this new viewing was it was kind of nice because like is that thing where you sort of settle into the like, oh, I know what's happening, I remember these scenes. But yeah, so we can just, like I said, we can just sort of freewheel, you know, talk about our favorite moments. We can, you know, roughly go through the plot. Yeah. So the movie, it's got like a little Galaga inspired, credit sequence, which is nice. You know, this movie is about video games, of course. It's an important pre-Gamergate text, in the realm of video game history. I'm saying that half jokingly and half not jokingly at all. So we start off with Alan Covert and fellow Salem Squad member Jonathan Loughran as his roommate playing Fight Night. I don't really see, like later on we see Nick Swardson's character has a Fight Night poster, and I don't really see a lot of these characters as like Fight Night type dudes, even in video game form. But you know, that's fine. They had to get their product placement in.
I mean, like one question I wanted to ask the group, because like, I've always been a very like casual gamer throughout my life. Like I was always the roommate who enjoyed playing Call of Duty that was owned by my buddy. And like, that was always my relationship to video games. Like, yeah, this is fun, but I never like jumped into the world really on my own. And correct me if I'm wrong, but one of the things I always kind of found just kind of charming about grandma's boy's laziness is that like it seems to have a pretty loose relationship with video game culture accuracy. How would you feel about that? Like, and I mean, like the games that we see them play don't look that great, like at least as far as like the fake games. And it's kind of like just like this weird, like very fluid thing where like, oh, they're playing Fight Night and then they're playing Frogger and then they're kicking ass at Dance Dance Revolution. It's just kind of like all over the place. Just like, oh, video games, these nerds are into it. And that's enough for you, right, guys? Like, I feel like if this were made today, it would have more of a devotion to be like accurate to the world.
Well, that's a great sort of like segue into like this point, which I think is a big point for Grandma's Boy, is that it is being a time capsule of 2006, like the way 2006 pop culture sort of viewed video games. Obviously video games were already a huge industry at that point. I mean, the release of something like Halo 2, which was only like a year before this, and you see many posters for it in the background of shots. That was like a huge, huge, I mean, like a movie release, like 7-Eleven had branded like cups for Master Chief or whatever. And so you know, obviously video games had become a big deal financially. But I think that the idea of, I think there was still, as you can tell from this movie, there was still the cultural perception of it. Maybe because we had not grown up yet to become like actual adults ourselves, but there was this sense of like, well, yeah, but it's still just like teenage boys mm-hmm. playing these things. And if it's not teenage boys, it's like stunted man children. And that is sort of part of the comedic premise of this movie, is that there is something to, like, Alan Covert being a guy at 35. Now, I also have to mention, he was 42 when he shot this.
He sure was, yeah.
He definitely looks 42 because my girlfriend, like, was freaking out. She was like, no, he can't be 35. Yeah. It was awful.
I felt real weird watching this, like, on my birthday, being like, I'm 34. Is that what I look like?
Am I going to look like Alan Covert? But so there is, like, the way that he, like, they don't ever say it in these terms because, you know, Doris Roberts, you know, sweetly gets into his video game habit and Linda Cardellini has no problem with it, obviously. But there's definitely a sense that, like, he justifies his being sort of a, forget the stoner aspect of it, but being an adult man who plays video games by, like, designing one. And like, mm-hmm. that's the thing where it's like, if he was just a video game tester, if he was just someone who liked to play video games a lot, like that's like, there's like, that's sort of coded as loser behavior.
Right.
And whatever you think, whether you think, you know, I'm sure there are people out there listening who would still find that to be true about adults playing video games. The cultural ground has definitively shifted away from that to now, like, it's almost weird now when I meet someone who doesn't like video games or like doesn't play them. Like, you know, I have like one or two friends who are just like, oh no, I never play games. And it's just like, wow, really? Like, you know, but what do you do to relax?
I don't even own a TV.
Right. So yeah, the depiction of gamers is interesting. I mean, most of them are depicted as like very young, like, you know, like teenagers or like just out of being a teenager. I'm not sure how old Nick Swardson is supposed to be in this movie. He still lives with his parents and his mom drives him everywhere. I don't know. It's interesting.
Well, and it's like whenever you see Nick Swardson at his house, he's very like he's very infantile. What's the
infantilized
word? Yeah, infantilized, and like he's wearing like a onesie jammy, and he has his car bed, and like he's sucking his thumb. And then like at work, he's kind of like the cool dude who's just like burning everyone and stuff. Which I guess is kind of a funny joke if they're even going for it, or again, if it's again just sort of a reflection of this movie's very casual relationship to establishing this world.
there was part of me that was watching this and I don't know if there are bits and pieces of this world that don't seem very lived in and don't make sense. Like at their lunch break when they go and play games and it's like, they'll play like Pong style games or like things that are like super basic. And I'm just kind of like, I don't feel like we as people, I'm saying we as people that play games, I haven't played games in a little bit, but
as gamer Americans.
Yeah. As gamer Americans, I don't feel like we harken back and go like, let's play Pong, because that's how we really break out who's better than each other in this world. Or are you playing like Halo against one of them?
I mean, I feel like it could be sort of posed as like a badge of honor type thing. It's like, if you're good enough, because those old games are almost uniformly difficult as shit. Yeah. And so it's like, if someone challenged me to like do a speed run through like the original Zelda game, I'd be like, no, I can't. I'll die of stress. So yeah, I don't know. But it was interesting that they like jumped to, what was that game? I couldn't tell.
Like Frogger or like Frog Pong or whatever it's called.
Yeah, it wasn't Frogger.
Frogger, but it's some kind of froggy game. I don't know.
Yeah, but they literally show the cover, and that's the other thing that I wanted to bring up about. I mean, we'll be talking about it throughout the episode, but mention about this movie's usage of depiction of the world of video games. It's so haphazard. Like the collection of games you see, like either like all represented, like, you know, Fight Night, like, you know, you have a big EA Sports title. All the characters have like Halo 2 posters. around, but they're also playing, you know, Dance Dance Revolution. They're also nowadays, it just goes to show you how much bigger video games are now, because nowadays you could get a couple of those if they were all from the same company and you made a deal for licensing in your movie. But back then it was very clear that they were just like giving this away. Like these licenses or whatever, because like it just feels like everyone's just like, oh, you want to have a video game in a movie? Cool. So yeah, it's interesting. So anyways, yeah, it's basically a documentary about the video game industry circa 2005. So we start off and we've got Jonathan Loughran playing Fight Night. He like unplugs the controller. This movie is filled with Microsoft definitely got their money's worth, because the Xbox controller is turned right to the camera several times. In a way, like later on, there's a shot where he's showing his grandma how to play, how to like what to press. And the shot, I like paused it. And the shot is literally just like, there's nothing on screen but the Xbox controller and their hands, but it's just like the Xbox logo in our face for the entirety of the scene. And it was pretty funny. Not intentionally, I don't think, but.
And are some of these fake games also like made exclusively for Xbox, or am I making that up? I feel like there was a game that towards the end, they put a game on screen, like a case. And I want to say it's like in an Xbox case. This could be just me feeling like I saw enough Xbox and I just made that assumption, but
all I know is that I don't remember that, but Demonic, the game that he is creating, that Alan Covert is creating, that was a game that was supposed to be released, because they partnered, I guess, for research and like, you know, they partnered with this developer. I don't know the name of it. And they were like, yeah, you can like use Demonic as like the game that your guy is making, and that'll be advertising for our game. The game never ended up releasing, which I don't think has anything to do with Grandma's Boy. Based on footage that we see, it probably has more to do with the fact that it's not a very good game.
Yeah, the game got canceled before Grandma's Boy even got released. And it was from the same company that was making that awful-looking Taxi Driver sequel game. Look that up online, and you'll see what a mess that would have been.
Yeah, go down the rabbit hole of the Taxi Driver video game that was like actually in development.
Really? Wow.
Yeah. It's fascinating. Yeah, but there was a period of time, not to derail this too much, but like there was a period of time where it was like, did they make that Godfather video game? I think they did, actually.
Yeah.
But it was like, suddenly it was like, oh, we can just go hog wild with like the licenses or whatever. And it's just like, oh, like movies that have no business being turned into video games. Like the Godfather, I guess, has a little bit more grounding, like in the post Grand Theft Auto world. But yeah, Taxi Driver, man, that's, I remember vividly reading about that and being like, oh no. So they're playing video games. Who cares? Rob Schneider shows up as their landlord. And
Yuri
threatens to, yeah, as Yuri, another one in the long line of questionable ethnic stereotypes that Rob Schneider has decided to perform. And it turns out Jonathan Loughran hasn't been paying the rent. He's been paying it on Filipino hookers. They get kicked out. They get kicked out of their place. And so Jonathan Loughran has to go live with Nick Swardson.
Or Alan Covert goes to live with Nick Swardson.
What did I say?
Jonathan Loughran.
Oh, Jonathan Loughran. Sorry. Jonathan Loughran. Alan Covert has to go. Jonathan Loughran goes to live with the Filipino hookers. Alan Covert goes to live with Nick Swardson and his super awesome race car bed. He's got, the Fight Night poster, the Halo 2 poster. He's got a Guilty Gear poster. I'm only mentioning this because later I have a note about the set design, the production design, that I think this bears relationship to. Alan Covert, in the funniest scene in the movie, at least when I was 17, and probably still this time, decides he's going to go jerk off in the bathroom to one of Nick Swardson's like female action figures. And he's talking dirty to her, and he like bends her over, and he's looking at her like action figure anatomy. And then who should
is it supposed to be Lara Croft?
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. Oh, okay. Yeah. And who should? And he's standing over the toilet, you know, beaten off. And who should walk into the room but but Nick Swardson's mother. And Alan Covert turns around, sees her, and they're both shouting, and Alan Covert can't stop coming.
It feels so good.
I'm sorry. I can't stop coming. It feels so good. And so Alan Covert can no longer stay. Sadly, he can no longer stay with Nick Swardson. So he goes to his office at Brainasium, the video game development company, responsible for what is it? Eternal Death Slayer 1, 2, and coming up, Eternal Death Slayer 3.
And they talk about Eternal Death Slayer as being like a, I don't know, like a Halo-esque game changer game, yeah. I suppose, which is fine. Like, I just love these fake game names in this movie. Eternal Death Slayer, Demonic. And I'm like, okay, yeah, sure.
Yeah, and when you see The Office, so Linda Cardellini, as the only female with a, as the only non-septuagenarian female with a speaking role, she's like come on to be like project manager to get Eternal Death Slayer 3 out on time, and she comes into the office and Alan Covert is there and they kind of have a little meet cute. This is a classic. This is not a Sandler movie, but this is a classic case of a slumming love interest. Like maybe the slummingest love interest we've ever seen in our podcast.
You really can't overstate. Well, I was gonna say like Cardellini in this movie being the like the bellwether of a good sport of just like doing this movie, taking on this role. I was gonna say that, and that is true, but just watching it, like I don't know, like I also really like her in this movie too. She's super charming and grounded, and like I don't want to overstate it or give this movie too much credit. She's the hot boss at the office and the movie doesn't need her to be anything else, but she takes that bullshit trope and makes something of a character out of it because it's Cardellini and she's awesome and she's a pro. But I like her in this thing. Like I like absolutely she's a slumming love interest, but I feel like her dignity remains intact and actually manages to create some chemistry with Alan Covert. So good on you.
This was like right after Brokeback Mountain.
Right after Brokeback Mountain, and I think she might have still been on ER at the time.
Okay, this is we're almost 2 years post Velma.
Yeah, jinkies.
Here's how I mark Linda Cardellini, because I didn't see Freaks and Geeks before I saw Scooby Doo. that came later. So, anyways, she comes in and has a little meet cute with Alan Covert. The head of the company is played by Kevin Nealon. He's like a weird hippy dippy kind of dude. Lots of talking about
he's like playing like I was gonna say like he's kind of in the pocket of his guy in Happy Gilmore, like very kind of woo-woo and hippy dippy, only now he's like a CEO of a video game. Like all of our Sandler stalwarts in this thing are kind of are like it is sort of a Happy Madison greatest hits, because you have Schneider doing the ethnically ambiguous landlord and all that. And also too, by the way, like I think his character here holds true to that theory that I was starting to work on last time, where like when he's doing these ethnic things, it works if they are non-specific. So like in this one, like as well as Big Daddy, when he's not riffing on a specific region or accent or whatever, if it's left ambiguous, he could just sort of be silly and it's fine. It's when he's doing like the Chuck and Larry stuff where it's like, no, don't go there. You should probably be ashamed of yourself and so on.
I thought he was trying to do Russian in this.
I guess.
But it's a Russian name, right?
Yeah. It's Eastern European. It's just, I feel like it's important that they don't specify. And then
yeah. He's in the clear.
the guy who the genius prodigy behind Brainasium's success play what's his character's name?
JP
played by Joel David Moore. Yes,
played by Joel David Moore, who of course went on to be the star of the biggest highest-grossing film of all time, James Cameron's Avatar.
That's right.
He's also good in Art School Confidential.
That's right. He was in, I recognized him at the time from Dodgeball, which he had been in like a year and a half before. But mainly he's in Avatar and Avatar 2. That's a sweet gig to have gotten 13 years ago and to like still be on deck.
You know what else he's in?
What's
he's
that?
In Avatar 3. Hey! And 4. And 5.
Well, that's so great to know that he lives through Avatars 2, 3, and 4. All bets are off for 5. He can die in 5. We don't know, but IMDb has told us.
I mean, hey, good for him. Between Avatar, obviously, but also just the longevity of Grandma's Boy. Like, that's a man who will never and should never pay for a drink. Like, good on you, buddy.
Yeah, I mean, if I ever saw him, I'd be like, oh my God, you're the Naughty from The Hottie and the Naughty.
I saw him do an interview from like a couple years ago, and he's open to Grandma's Boy too. He's close friends with Nick Swardson, calls him Swarty.
That's great. Oh, that's sweet. He's also nothing that I've ever seen or much heard of, but he's also become a director in the intervening years. Like he's directed some movies. I don't know. I saw some movie he directed with like Billy Crudup was the star. So it's like, you know, he's good for him. He's out there making his career.
Yeah. He did this movie, Spiral.
Yes. I remember hearing about this at Fantastic Fest, like the year that I tried to go, and I went to one day and got like the flu and had to stay home for the rest of the week. I think it's like him and Amber Tamblyn, is that right? In Spiral, and he's playing like a creepy stalker type, perhaps.
That sounds about right. Yeah. It looks like Zachary Levi was also in it. I haven't seen it since around that time, but yeah. I recall really thinking it was good. And I guess he was kind of in the pocket with Adam Green, who did like Hatchet as well.
Yes.
The co-director. Right. So he's got Avatar. He's got like indie horror of the mid 2000s, Grandma's Boy. He's kind of like spread his wings.
Man, I'm having some serious flashbacks to mid-aughts, I'll tell you, with like some of these credits.
So yeah, he's just like an obnoxious like jackass who he's an obnoxious jackass who dresses like Neo from The Matrix and does like this weird robot voice like half the time. It's like, I feel like there's, the movie never actually made me think this, but like looking back on it, it's like, oh, there could be like a problem. There could be like they could have done this in a very bad way where it seemed like he was like on the spectrum somehow, or like, so like right. His behavior, if you just described it to someone, it'd be like, oh, is that like, is he like neurodivergent?
You know, what's funny is that like Grandma's Boy came out, what, I guess a year or two before that documentary, the King of Kong, or the King of Kongs. Mm-hmm. Where, and he's, and I mean, like his, like JP's whole thing is like, oh, he's like, he's a prodigy, and he, you know, and he designed EDS, Eternal Death Slayer, when he was 13. It's like, oh, he, like, it's like they accidentally stumbled into like a Billy Mitchell kind of thing almost with him, but obviously they sort of take their own little Matrix nerd direction with it, but he's kind of that, like, he's that sort of guy.
Yeah.
And he does have one of my favorite lines in the movie. The whole robot noise voice thing gets a little old, but when he's first talking to Linda Carlini and just talking her ear off, and she's just kind of humoring him, but he says something like, oh, all like, oh, school, all I ever cared about was video games. So maybe I don't know what the Civil War was or who invented the helicopter, even though I own one. But I did beat The Legend of Zelda by the time I was 13. That's cool.
Oh, it's
before he could walk.
Oh, before I could walk. That's right. Yeah. Excuse me.
Which, again, is hella impressive because that game's impossible.
There's a little bit of, like, also, like, some in that kind of prodigy style. Isn't there a prodigy in Pixels? Where there was, like, maybe not a prodigy, but, like, I was good at games when I was young. And
The Peter Dinklage character is, like, yeah, it's, like, because it's supposed to be, Sandler was also great at video games when he was younger in that movie, but Peter Dinklage is, like, the asshole who's, like, you know, like, oh, like, it, we, you know, gotta resettle the score or whatever.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, they're just, like, little pieces of that just seem familiar, and I'm, like, I'm probably gonna reference Pixels again, because I guess these are, like, they're kind of similar in at least subject matter.
Yeah, they're definitely cousins in the Sandler cinematic universe. I mean, just by dint of being about video games, yeah. If nothing else. It is interesting. So briefly on that note, with the wider Sandler world, it is interesting that this movie was put out by not by Sony. And one of the reasons, because they had their like production deal, maybe this happened more regularly after like after this movie, but they were pretty much exclusively Sony Pictures there for a good long while, and before their Netflix deal. And one of the ways that I could tell that this was not a Sony movie, even if I had not noticed the production company credits at the beginning, is that they keep showing the damn Xbox and not, there's not a PlayStation 2 in sight. So I don't know. It was kind of interesting. Yeah, JP's a huge jerk, makes robot noises, flirts creepily with Linda Cardellini. Let's see. Like I said, so this video game office, this office, I have issue with, I take some issue with the production design here, because the layout of posters that are, or that, like the things that are adorning the walls in these this office of like cubicles or whatever, it's the most chaotic selection of random stuff. Like why would you have on a wall, why would you have the original poster for the original Star Wars right next to a poster of Blood Rain 2? Why would you have several Game Informer covers that were blown up to be the size of a poster when like the Game Informer covers are real cover? It's not like the fictional games that they made. They're real games. So it's like the Game Informer for Grand Theft Auto San Andreas. And it's like, well, why in the world would they have this like up there? And right next to the Star Wars poster, there's Blood Rain 2, which is just very strange. Although, fun connection, because the Blood Rain movie did come out the same weekend as Grandma's Boy. So someone out there, one person probably had a really fun double feature that weekend.
It's this weird combination of like obvious product placement combined with like, they're nerds. Video games, just put it all up there. Like it's very scatterbrained.
The studio that worked on Blood Rain was also working on Demonic, so that was probably part of it. Just whatever was around.
Do you think they went? Do you think that on opening weekend, most of their crew went to see the Blood Rain movie, or? Which one do you think hurt more? The one that featured the game that was never released, or the one that was made by Uwe Boll?
Is Blood Rain the one with Mila Jovovich?
No, it's Kristanna Loken from Terminator 3.
Okay.
Yep, and Michael Madsen and Michelle Rodriguez.
Wow. Yeah.
Michelle Rodriguez at her lowest point post Fast and the Furious. Pre-Avatar, definitely was like, oh man, whatever happened to her? And then like now she's great. She's a huge movie star. But
I guess I want to talk about Doris Roberts a bit, who right there next to Linda Cardellini is like, you know, the model of being a good sport and kind of classes this whole joint up a bit. Upon many, many rewatches and thinking about this movie way more than it was ever intended to be thought about, I like how Doris Roberts, as well as Cardellini, like grounded, like they genuinely, just through the sheer will of their professionalism and charm, they emotionally ground a movie that otherwise doesn't have much interest in being emotionally grounded. But, you know, and it's Doris, probably what, like a year or two after Everybody Loves Raymond ended, wearing her wardrobe from Everybody Loves Raymond. Like she's definitely in that mode of Marie, just, you know, a sweeter version of Marie. There's that scene that always kind of like just throws me for a loop in a good way in this movie. And it's like the morning after their big party blowout at the house, and like even all the old ladies are getting stoned and stuff and just having a good time. And Doris is drinking beer and just very easily mingling with all the crazy stoners who are there. And it's the morning after, and there's Alan Covert, there's Linda Cardellini, and there's Doris Roberts. And like, it's this disarmingly out of nowhere sweet scene where they're talking about Alex's grandfather and how he's no longer with them. And she like cries a little bit and Linda's like comforting her. It's this weird thing. I mean, like it's it's a very sweet little exchange between them in this movie that otherwise has Jonah Hill sucking a, like big fake titties like 5 minutes earlier. it's little touches like that that kind of, I feel like, sort of make this movie weirdly better than you'd even expect it to be. I don't know. Like that little bit always stuck out with me. It's like, why is this scene here? This movie has no interest in this type of emotional sincerity otherwise, but yet there it is. I dig it.
Yeah. I honestly felt like that scene, I was just like, all right, we're marking time here. Like, get to the, like, this is just the point in the screenwriting process where it was like, well, I guess this is the place where a scene like this would be in a real movie. But no, of course, Doris Roberts just sells the hell out of all this stuff. I kept thinking about her while, like, any time she was on screen, I was just like, man, this must have been fun for her to film. Like, when she's passed out and, like, the folks are, like making out, like, having sex near her. All that stuff. The bit where... So he goes to live with them. He goes and sees her at his cousin's wedding, and she's like, "Oh, our roommate Sophie died, and so you can come live with us." And so he eventually ends up going to live with them, which is the crux of the movie. And she tells him that Sophie, he's like, "She didn't die in the bed, did she?" And she's like, "Oh no, she died right here on the floor. It's just like right next to the bed." I think this time around, the jerking off scene is the funniest scene in the movie for me. It's just, he goes to sleep, or tries to go to sleep, and he's awoken, and there's this portrait of this old woman, and it's just the ghostly, like, "Oh, hey, Phil, I lay here on the floor, and nobody helped me." And he's just like, "Oh my God, oh my God, oh my God." And then it turns out it's Doris Roberts just fucking with him, just playing a little trick. And I just like, oh man, it's that kind of thing that made me wish, like, oh man, I bet you it would have been fun to work on this movie. Cause like her, you know, like she was like riding high with like Everybody Loves Raymond and stuff. Like she was, you know, very well known at the time. And she just like had to be like a change of pace for her. Like, and she takes to it very well. She's a delight to watch. He has this video game called Demonic that he's been programming in his spare time and somewhat implausibly has told not one single person about the entire time.
He was feeling self-conscious about it, Wilson.
I guess. We've skipped right past Peter Dante. Peter Dante. Yeah. Sandler Squad stalwart. Not so much lately. Lately he's more been the star of Instagram videos or arrest videos where he's like, "I know Adam Sandler," when he's really wasted. But for a while there, he was regularly appearing in Sandler movies, and he plays Alan Covert's pot dealer. And his bit, you're constantly like in his basement, and they're smoking together. You know, it's a setup like Pineapple Express, James Franco's room or something. But he's talking about how he wants to get a lion. He's ordering a lion from Africa. And as the movie progresses, he ends up collecting a motley crew of cultural stereotypes, including an African tribal leader.
Dr. Shakaloo.
And a Chinese Taekwondo master. These people help him to acquire first a lion, which escapes and rampages, and they see it on the other characters see it on the news at some point. And then later on, a monkey. And the monkey is featured prominently on the poster. I think it was like with a button on one of the trailers where it's like that monkey flies down the stairs and like karate kicks Peter Dante. this was the stuff that my friend in high school thought was the funniest. It is pretty funny. Peter Dante is pretty good in these scenes.
Can I point out real quick the African chief, Dr. Shakaloo, in this movie? That's played by the actor His name is Abdoulaye Nam, N-G-O-M, his last name. And he plays Dr. Shockaloo, and we know him also in Blended and That's My Boy.
That's right. Yeah, I remember him from Blended for sure while we were watching.
Yes.
Up later. Oh boy. We kind of mentioned in passing, Jonah Hill is one of Alan Covert's like friends at the video game company, and they keep, you know, Jonah Hill, you know, this was the same year. It's not his first film role because he was in I Heart Huckabee.
He was in, I remember him from 40 Year Old
Accepted.
Virgin. Or Accepted. Or, was that,
40, oh, he's in, is he in 40 Year Old Virgin?
He's buying like these goldfish boots from Catherine Keener.
Catherine Keener, yes. He's the weirdo at the eBay store buying the goldfish boots. And
okay, I remember that now. Future Oscar nominee, double Oscar nominee, and very serious actor Jonah Hill here, still with his funny weight on, and his it was this one of these things where like when he showed up in Superbad a year and a half after this movie, it was definitely one of the, it was like, hey, it's that guy that I've seen in movies,
right?
Grandma's Boy or 40-Year-Old Virgin.
And the thing is, like, with Grandma's Boy and like all the times that we watched it that first year at college, I remember whenever his character would pop up, our frame of reference, maybe if someone had seen Accepted, which not many people had, but like maybe someone would bring that up. But for the most part, it's like, oh, it's that funny boy from the 40-Year-Old Virgin. It's the eBay store guy. Mm-hmm. And then, yeah, like as you point out, Wilson, like, you know what, a short year later, they're super bad. It's like, oh, this is a movie star. Wow. Who fucking knew?
He's just one of his virgin friends. Covert, while he's living with his grandma and her friends, these two other elderly women, he's telling his friends at the office that what he's actually doing is living with like three hot babes, and that they're like keeping him like, and he's constantly exhausted at work because he's living with his grandma. They wake him up like in the morning and make him do all these chores, all these like physically exhausting chores. And so like, he keeps coming to the office too exhausted to work, passing out, stuff like that. And as cover, he explains to his friends that he's been sleeping with three really hot babes and they've just been like, you know, riding him all night, basically. I'm trying to get a hold of this fucking bronco of a story. I don't know, like JP continues flirting with Linda Cardellini. They're having development issues on Eternal Death Slayer 3 at one point. I had questions about the hierarchy of this company because at one point someone goes to JP and is like, well, what if the elves in this level and the elves in this level look really similar? What if we just made them different colors? Which, by the way, that's already a super lazy workaround, but they treat it as like, oh my God, like you cracked the code. and then JP then goes to Linda Cardellini and is like, you could do this. And I'm like, I understand it's not supposed to be super accurate to like the business structure, but it's still just like, no, I'm pretty sure they like delegate. Like, I'm pretty sure it's just like weird. It's like there would be someone beneath Linda Cardellini he could go and tell that to. although I guess he just wants an excuse to speak with her. Alan Covert brings weed back to his grandma's house and he stores it in this tin that Sophie used to have like on her mantle. And at one point, while he's away at work, Doris Roberts and her friends, they make tea with the pot. Does this work? Can you just steep marijuana flower into tea? Is that a thing? I'm not sure it is.
Pretty sure the Beatles did it.
Okay. Well, there you go. So they do that. They get mega, mega stoned. It's very funny. We've totally missed the Antiques Roadshow bit. Can anyone watch Antiques Roadshow? Explain that.
How Antiques Roadshow works?
Yeah, someone who watched it. I've never seen
it. My dad watches it, I think, every night. So, yeah, it's basically they'll just go, from what I understand, like town to town, and they'll like set up in a convention center, and you basically just say like, well, I got this old beer stein that I found in my granny's closet. What's it worth? And then there's some person that gives an appraisal of like, this, sir, is from the 17th century, and gives it $1,500. And then I think you can go cash out and get money for it. I don't know if it's that, or if you just walk home and say, I think it's worth $1,500. Who's going to buy it? But longstanding PBS show.
Nicer version of Pawn Stars.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. It's a classy Pawn Stars, essentially.
Gotcha. Okay. So they love to watch it. The old ladies are obsessed. And that apparently does come from Alan Covert's real life. He said that when he lived with his grandma for 2 weeks, she just like sat really close to the TV and watched Antiques Roadshow constantly with the volume turned too loud. Classic grandma behavior. At a certain point, I guess because of the fix on is it because of the workaround they do with the elf coloring? There's something there for whatever reason they decide to like Kevin Nealon tells Linda Cardellini to treat the team to dinner.
Yeah, like they're celebrating all their testing levels being completed and they're back on schedule for the game.
Right, which is weird because Alan Covert seemingly has not had any time to test any of these levels. Like they keep making mention of that fact.
He's able to catch up with it. He's able to catch up with his levels once he buys the ladies tickets to go see
Antiques
Roadshow. Yeah.
That's right. Okay. Yeah. Because there's another thing earlier where he's, I did laugh at this, when he's trying to make, he brings the weed home and he's trying to make munchies. Like he has like huge thing. He's like, oh, there's all this food. And like, finally, a roommate who cooks. And all this stuff out. And then he realizes his grandma doesn't have a microwave. So he puts it all in the oven. And then he goes to grab it later when it's, you know, hot as hell. And he forgets to put on oven mitts and just like burns the shit out of his hands. I just thought it was funny, but like the bit about the microwave.
He puts a banana in that oven. that was one thing. Like that whole plate. It's like an unpeeled, like it is a unpeeled banana, just ripe and just ready to go.
Like, you want to brown it a little bit, dude. You get a little broil going, and you get it's a nice banana.
You know what this also reminds me of? One of those like moments where it's just like what? And that's it's very funny to me. I guess this was in his chores scene, but he lifts up the couch.
Oh, that is true. Like
3 to 4 dead cats just stuck on the couch. Hubie Halloween style dead cat too.
He just puts the couch back down. He doesn't want to deal with those cats.
That was really upsetting to my girlfriend. She was just like, wait, is he not going to do anything about those cats? Like, I guess not.
They're already dead.
It's too horrifying to contemplate. Linda Cardellini, I believe she was explicitly told to like take the entire team out, but who she ends up taking out is Alan Covert, Jonah Hill, Nick Swardson, and their friend, the other member of the team, the Asian guy. They go to, I guess because it was suggested by Kevin Nealon's hippy dippy character, they go to a vegan restaurant. This is a scene I have to spend at least a moment unpacking.
I couldn't wait to talk about this scene specifically with you, Wilson, just because it's such vegan minstrelsy.
So you're not wrong. As somebody who very recently, so I've been vegan for about 5 years, and someone who recently has like attempted, after a bout with breakthrough COVID, has attempted to make an attempt to like eat, like whenever I can, like eat pretty healthily, like even more so than just like eating vegan like vegetables and stuff. This scene was very triggering to me because the stuff when they're just like, you know, so they go to this vegan restaurant and they sit down and David Spade is their waiter.
Shiloh.
Playing a character named Shiloh. And he's kind of, for lack of a better word, mincing And he explains to them that they're basically like, it's you know, nowadays, so here's the thing, and this is another kind of time capsule thing about this movie, is that nowadays a restaurant like that would not be seen, except by like your like Tim Allen Last Man Standing types. This would not be seen as like a, like my dad, it wouldn't be his first choice, but my meat loving dad, if I took him to a restaurant like that, he'd be like, he'd roll with it. He'd be like, sure, okay. Like, and so like, it's just funny that back then it was like, okay, here's like an easy, here's an easy gag. And the gag is vegans are weird and they don't eat grease or fat. And they don't have alcoholic drinks on their menu, which, I mean, most every vegan restaurant I've been to has booze. But, you know, this is like clearly like macrobiotic, healthy, like, you know, kind of vegan cooking. And David Spade, here's the thing that saves the scene for me. David Spade is weirdly like solicitous of them, like, for like 90% of the scene, he's just like, okay, guys, I know. Like, they're being like rude as shit to his face. And he's just like, I know. Like, we're a little different from other restaurants. But he's like, to me, maybe because I'm a dirty vegan, he didn't read as like obnoxious. The other people read as obnoxious. and I think that the scene validates that by paying off with, they decide to leave and go to a nearby burger joint and get some beers. And David Spade just snaps, and he's just like you people make me sick. Like, your attitude, you're so superior. Oh, let's make fun of the vegans. We're not hurting anyone. and that was the bit where I was like, my girlfriend was like making fun of me for this scene, and I was just like, and then when he was just like, we're not hurting anyone, I was like, see, like.
It cracks me up every time, and it has a great little capper when like they're all leaving, and the whole time Linda Cardellini, because like she's the one sweet adult of this pack of assholes, she like on their way out, she's like, I'm really sorry about this, sir, and then it cuts back to Spade, he's like, you were sweet.
He said that, like, I swear to God, it's like the scene has like already cut away when he said that. It's just like, it is eager to get away from that. But yeah, that moment was funny. Yeah, so that was very triggering as a vegan. It should have been a content warning. But David Spade brought it home. And so, yeah, what happens? Oh yeah, somehow there's a house party. Why is there a house party? Remind me.
I think it's just like, they ditch the vegan place. They go to Tommy Burger down the street. Great fake name for a burger joint. And
Tommy's is real. No, oh, is it? It Tommy Shit. Burger. They've got great chili burgers.
They're hell. I didn't realize.
In and out competitor.
Nice. Cool. So they go to Tommy's and they're having their burgers and beer and they're all just having a good time. And then Cardellini's like, oh, I could totally smoke some weed right now. And then Alex like, oh, well, let me call up Dante. And then calling up Dante turns into Dante inviting all of his crazy friends over to grandma's house and it just becomes a party scene.
They, one striking thing, they bring a lot of Steel Reserve, which is like, it's like, I guess it was like a mid 2000s. It's still around. It's just one of those like very high alcohol content things that you never really see in a movie. And it's just so unique to see it. You see Red Stripe in the movie.
You see Red Stripe, yeah.
You never
Sierra Nevada.
And Sierra Nevada.
Yeah.
Oh, Peter Dante likes Sierra Nevada so much that not only does he have one on his coffee table turned the label facing the camera directly, but he also has like a lit up bar sign for Sierra Nevada like on his wall behind him. He's a huge fan.
Also, weirdly, one of the just a strange specific thing in this movie, or really just product placement, obviously. But I just remember my first couple of years of college when, you know, none of us were yet 21. So the beer that we were drinking was almost exclusively like Keystone or Natty Light. And the few times that we could like maybe pull our money together for like good beer, actual beer, our like fancy choice was Sierra Nevada Pale Ale. Like that was like my first grown-up beer, like, oh yeah, like I'm drinking classy tonight because I have Sierra Nevada. So anytime I would see it pop up like in a comedy from this era, which I felt like was fairly often, I don't know, I guess if Sierra Nevada was having a moment, I was just do like the thing.
I do have a brief list we can run down of, and if I'm forgetting any, please remind me. But we're not technically doing the categories right now. But I did write down the product placement I made note of, and this does not include the video game stuff. Like, we'd be here all night. What I have is we've got Lay's, like just Lay's potato chips. You get Frito-Lay later, like Fritos later on. We got Sierra Nevada. We got vitamin water. We got Pepsi. We got Xbox. We got Mountain Dew. We got Sobe, or is it Sobe? This was a question last night.
Sobe was, that was how I pronounced it.
I like it. It's like, I think it's like Kobe beef. And so I'll continue to refer to it when ordering it in fine establishments. I'll continue to refer to it as Sobe. I never had Sobe. What was it?
Was it like guava something or another? Like, I remember they had some sort of fusion at one point with Dr. Pepper where you can get, I think this is correct. You could get like a Dr. Pepper that had guava from Sobe infused in it or something like that.
Interesting. Wow.
The flavor of it escapes me.
Okay. Good to know. We got Sierra Mist. We got Red Stripe. We got Guinness and Steel Reserve. Yeah, that Steel Reserve, I'd not seen that in a while. I'd not clocked Steel Reserve in a long time. I've never had it before. Man, my dog's making a lot of noise, you guys. So anyways, this party scene. So this party scene with the Steel Reserve, with like everyone in the movie, except for JP, he's not invited, LOL. Basically, it's every party scene you've ever seen in like a movie, like a teen movie from the aughts or a college movie from the aughts that had any movie that had an unrated DVD cover, your Old Schools, your Van Wilders, your American Pies and Euro Trips, things like that. Every one of those had a scene where you just like went through a house party and everyone was like super wasted and there were like lots of naked ladies with their boobs out. On that level, it's a pretty, so, you know, this is like a stoner movie, and stoner movies are like, usually I think of them as pretty, or weed movies are like fairly distinct from, you know, just like your typical college bro out movie. And this one kind of splits the difference in an interesting way. Like this movie, I think like it, cause it is like a weed comedy explicitly. But it also has its, it has a toe in, at least a toe in the, I don't know, that earlier post-American Pie era of like raunchy studio comedy.
Mm-hmm. I also get frat comedy vibes, like Animal House specifically, and even the Grandma's Boy poster seems to directly reference Animal House.
Yes, I had I had a print of this poster on my wall for a year or two of college, I'm proud and embarrassed to say, and definitely riffing on the Animal House thing. And it's actually a pretty great poster and DVD cover, depending on which version you have. Yeah, I think that's a good point, though. It's definitely has its feet in those different subgenres of comedies. That might explain, to some degree, its longevity.
I think definitely the fact that, like, again, I just think of my buddy in high school. It's like, for people who were, like, that age, like, people our age who are like at that point in time were like getting into weed, we're into video games and getting into weed. It was just like, it just came along right at the perfect time to like imprint itself on people's brains in a way where it's like, even if it has certain deficiencies as a film, it kind of doesn't matter because it just becomes like imprinted on your brain.
Yeah, it's definitely a right place, right time movie for a lot of people. I had forgotten about this earlier, actually, when we were talking about our relationship with the movie. But as you guys know, I'm at best kind of a casual smoker. But the first time, like, we were at a friend's place in college, and someone smoked me out for the first time. That was we were watching Grandma's Boy, so. I'll always have that too.
So at this party, this big house party, we've got, like I said, everyone's having a crazy big rager. Jonah Hill ends up with like this supermodel looking lady. And he's like sucking on her boobs. And it's, you know, he just like doesn't leave her, or the warm embrace of her breasts for the rest of the night and into the morning. We have Nick Swardson going to sleep, going to have to make sweet, sweet love to Shirley, I think. Or
is it? I think it's Shirley. Is Shirley, Jones. Shirley Jones or Shirley Knight?
Shirley Jones, I think.
It's Shirley Jones, and then Shirley Knight is B, like the pilled up lady. But yes, Shirley Jones is like the old nympho.
And so
it once gave Charlie Chaplin a hand job.
Was he silent?
Which was a great line in the trailer. I do remember that. And that's later on, the next morning, Nick Swardson wakes up in bed. They're in bed together, you know, post-coital bliss. And he says, you know, I have a confession to make. You were my first. And she goes, oh, you were something like my 3,000. And his reaction is pretty good. He sort of turns to the side and he goes, I really sure weren't a condom.
Later on, when he's with Shirley again, because like after this, like he's like there's that one bit of him being like, oh, that's kind of gross, but then like anytime you see him afterwards with her, he's totally like into it, and like he's finally found like his sexual and romantic awakening. And there's a bit later on when they're at the office, him and Shirley, and like they're off to try to find Grandma and Alex or whatever, and she's like, all right, so how much time do we have? And he just, without missing a beat, enough time to 69. And I think about that at least once a day.
Oh, and her reaction to enough time to 69, just like Don Knotts, which was a mental image I never needed.
Hello, Mayberry.
That was great. I love that. Oh, yeah.
Who wants to hear about my STD from the silent film era?
Oh, man. Yeah,
like I'm sorry, like Swardson kills it in this movie. Like, this is some good shit.
No, he's very funny in this. I guess we sort of skipped over the bit where they learn the office, his friends learn that he's not actually living with three hot chicks. He's living with his grandma and two other elderly women. I really love that Jonah Hill isn't phased at all. Jonah Hill's just like, that's so hot. Oh my God. It's like, that's funny. But also Nick Swardson being like rather than understanding what's actually going on, he's like, dude, like, have sex with your grandma. That's like too far.
Coming on my mom is one thing.
Right. So during the party, of course, after the party, you know, we get that scene that, you know, if I remember correctly, made Chris weep, and, the scene about his granddad, the sentimental, an old softy like Chris, his heart couldn't take it. But that night, before when they were all wasted, they had, Linda Cardellini had JP, Joel David Moore's number. And so they like called him and basically like made him feel shitty for not being at the party. And he comes over to Alan Covert's grandma's place. To basically, you know, to whine and cry about how like nobody likes him, and then he notices Alan Covert's game, demonic, and he's like, oh, what is that? And it's clear, you know, he's been like hard up for ideas, and like, you know, he's been feeling the heat. Joel David Moore, JP, and so he's like, yeah, I could take that video game, that one copy of the video game you've been making for 5 years without anyone knowing about it. I could take that home and give you some pointers and some feedback. And Alan Covert, huge idiot, is just like, yeah, sure, that'd be great. Now, don't forget, it's the only copy, and I haven't told a single soul about it. Like, no one would believe me in a court of law. And she's like, okay, man, this seemed bad. So, of course, the next day they, you know, they go in, there's a big meeting at Brainasium at the company, and like lo and behold, JP is showing his new game, and his new game is demonic. And Alan Covert, thankfully, I mean, like I was kind of, because I didn't remember how it all like worked out, and I could definitely like see like another movie where it's like they drag this out. I do like that Alan Covert is just like, no, fuck you, that's my game. He just quits on the spot. He's like, no, fuck you, like you took this from me. And turns out that Doris Roberts, we'd seen earlier, she was playing demonic. She was having a great time with Alan Covert, her grandson, showing her the ropes of how to play it. And she was like, you know, she was like getting checkpoints and ripping people apart, ripping, you know, killing meth dealers, really having a great time playing demonic, playtesting it for him. And Linda Carnelli, so Alan Covert goes to Peter Dante's place and is just like, just get every strain of weed we've talked about, the one that makes you think you got deer antlers, Incredible Hulk, you know, all these other things that you roll it up into one joint. And Peter Dante's like, no one's ever done that. And he's like, one man is brave enough. Linda Cardellini goes looking for Covert at his grandma's place, and Doris Roberts reveals, like, oh, right, you mean Alex's gang, demonic? And it's like, oh, shit, like, there's the proof that that he's telling the truth and the JP is lying. Linda Cardellini, like, they go to the office. Nick Swardson, realizing what's going on, he and Shirley Jones call in on Peter Dante's place, and they're like, dude, you gotta get over here because, like, you know, the boss is basically determining who's correct here. Like, your grandma's gonna do is gonna play against JP to prove that she, like, knows how to do it she knows the game better than he does. And Tyr, so some of the shenanigans that we've mentioned already with the weed dealer, you know, we have this Taekwondo instructor who's teaching the monkey how to do Taekwondo, and we learned that the monkey at this point is a red belt. He just, like, beats the shit out of the Taekwondo instructor. It's pretty funny. Well, we hear him beat the shit out of the Taekwondo instructor upstairs. This bit, when Alan Covert realizes, like, dude, I gotta get to work, but, like, I'm too stoned to drive. And Peter Dante is like, I'm too stoned to drive as well. And then they're like, hey, wait a minute. And then we the audience, are then treated to the worst rear screen projection on film. I'm including all the outdated Hitchcock rear screen projection. I'm even including the rear screen projection in Airplane that is intentionally supposed to be bad, where there's, like, hordes of people cycling behind them and, like, goats and cattle, like, running around. Like, it has no relation to what they're doing in the scene. The monkey is driving them to Brainasium, and they're just, like, cackling like maniacs.
Drive, monkey, drive.
Yeah, as you would if a monkey was driving you around. And so, yeah, they go back to Brainasium. Doris Roberts kicks JP's ass at demonic. I don't know. What happens after that?
They live happily ever after.
They all live happily ever after. I guess it's implied that Alex gets the girl, that Alex, you know, that demonic will probably go on to be a gigantic smash hit. I guess we have to assume that JP committed harakiri in disgrace. It's not stated outright, but, you know, to me it was heavily implied. That's the plot of Grandma's Boy. You know, we were definitely all over the place on that description. But then again, it's not exactly a rigorous movie to ponder. But it is, you know, it is funny, and it does have I think we could almost talk a little bit more about the aspect of, like, how it represents gamer culture. I mean, I know we have talked a lot about that, but I do find it interesting that it's, like, it is kind of like one thing, you know, we talked about how it had, like, the outdated, like, a different idea of, like, what a gamer is, you know. It was sort of like, oh, that's still just, like, a kid's toy or whatever. But there was an opportunity, I think, like, you know, especially with the JP character, there are occasionally these flashes of darkness that, like, were almost sort of like, oh, like, here, like, let's just say if, like, you could have, like, the same script for Grandma's Boy to, like, and if you tried to produce it today, the JP character would have to be, like, conceived of differently because of, like, the toxic online gamer culture stuff that we've seen since then. Not that the culture wasn't toxic back then, but, like, it's like, don't know. It's almost like it. I guess it's almost like the shift of like something like when you watch Revenge of the Nerds, and now the way people talk about, like, with good reason, talk about Revenge of the Nerds, and be like, oh, like some of those nerds, like, it's fucked up what they do. Mm-hmm. It's really like you know, it's not cool. We shouldn't, just because they're like, they're nerds, doesn't mean like it's cool for them to act like huge jerks. And you know, I don't think that's not like a huge issue. It doesn't like pull you out of the immersion while you're watching Grandma's Boy, but it is something that I thought of a couple of times. I was like, oh, like this is the conception of video games and it's their place in our world, and who plays video games is very different. And that includes the fact that there are no female speaking characters with the exception of the elderly women and Linda Cardellini. There's not one woman working on staff apparently at this game studio. It's just like, it's literally, I mean, at one point it's stated outright where he's just like, oh, like, you don't seem like someone who'd be working here. And Linda Cardellini's like, oh, you mean like because I'm a girl? And he's like, no, because you're a really hot girl. And it's like, okay.
And you're swimming in a sea of virgins. And it's like, okay, like, yeah. and it's interesting too how it kind of, I don't know with how much intention or not, but it kind of gets into this hierarchy, I suppose, of this gamer community and company. Because like you have when Cardellini is like leading a meeting with all the testers, they're all kind of like dorks and just acting like dumb boys and clearly very like enamored of her and all that. And then like when you see them going to lunch, it's like they're like the alpha jocks of this company. It's like, who wants to take on the champ? Shit's weak. Bring on the gray bush. Like, and like and all that stuff. Like they're like they're the fucking cool kids at this place, except when they're around literally anyone else in the movie.
Yeah, that briefly just reminded me that my friend who loved this in high school, he would always go shit's weak.
It's like, oh, man. Anytime we were playing Call of Duty after this movie came out, we would like say shit's weak, or if one of us did really well, we'd be like, what does that mean? What's that? Is that bad? Did I break it?
I have never played Dance Dance Revolution. Somehow I missed it the entire time. That was like a culture defining phenomenon. I'm told that they have a machine at pinballs. And so I should give it a shot sometime. I know you can get like at home versions, but
it's fun, but it requires a bit too much exertion for my taste.
I got a question for y'all. What do y'all think about Alan Covert as a leading man? Because this is his only leading performance.
I think it works here. but I have a tough times. This makes sense as his one-off, like in this context. Like in any other context, it would just feel strange. And I remember the first time I saw this without much like context or preface. It was just sort of like, oh, it's this funny movie, Grandma's Boy. And then I kind of caught up to what exactly it was as I was watching it. And probably for the first 10 or 15 minutes, I had trouble placing Alan Covert. I was like, I know this face. What's going on here? So finally it clicked. And I felt silly for not catching it, because how many times have I seen Wedding Singer? How many times have I seen Happy Gilmore? This and that. But what's interesting too is that aside from like, I guess Wedding Singer, or even then he kind of has funny 80s hair, and Big Daddy when he's, you know, playing sort of like a straight-laced looking lawyer guy. And most of his Sandler roles, his like, you know, supporting roles in Sandler movies, Covert almost always has some type of funny look to him. Like, I remember by the time we were watching Little Nicky during our run, and he has like this crazy what blonde hair, I think, in that movie. Or perhaps that's Mr. Deeds. I can't remember which one. But it's like, did he have a bet going with Sandler to like appear more and more ridiculous upon each movie? So to the point where when you see him in this one, he's just sort of like a average looking dude wearing jeans and t-shirts. It's like he looks weird when he just looks normal. I don't know. I think he's charming enough and likable here, but again, like, it's really only in the context of this movie that I could see, like, imagine sort of spending 90 minutes with him. And it helps that he's surrounded by very colorful people, and he's able to just kind of like blend in as just sort of a smarmy straight man. But you know, I think it works here. I have a tough time imagining it elsewhere. I don't know. What do you guys think?
I like Alan Covert in this. I feel like he's a convincing pothead gamer who lives with his grandma. But I had a hard time not imagining Adam Sandler in this role. Like, I feel like Covert gives a different performance, and he's probably a little better suited. I feel like he seems a little smarter in this than Sandler would have played it, a little less angry, perhaps.
Yeah.
But Variety even called Grandma's Boy an Adam Sandler film, sans Adam.
Yeah. I mean,
well, yeah. That is interesting, though, thinking about it's like, yeah, like Sandler reads as, I mean, like, even when he's like, because he has kind of lost the anger as like the years have gone on. Like, he doesn't seem as reflexively like he's going to, like, you know, choke you out if you insult him, like, sort of thing. But he does sort of have like a like, it's smarm isn't the right word, but like sort of a cutting sense. I can't see him as like, it's weird to think of him as like laid back. It's weird to think of him as, or laid back in the way of like a video game playing stoner. Like, you know, there's the laid back of, I'm going to wear nothing but basketball shorts and my favorite restaurant is Hooters, but that's distinct from what Alan Covert is playing in this movie. So yeah, that's interesting. I had not thought about Sandler in the role, but it's a different energy.
Yeah. And I mean, I kind of like, and again, I'm going to go back to that sweet heart tugging scene that everyone else is rolling their eyes at, but there's like a line of dialogue where it's talking about how Alex was actually a really good student when he was growing up, and like by the time he got to college, he discovered weed and just kind of like just smoked himself out of any sort of like ambition or like intellectual pursuits. And I feel like that kind of tracks in his character here. Like, he's clearly like a smart guy and capable, you know, and like smart enough to design a game and have like that dedication to do it. I recently rewatched Stripes with Bill Murray the other week, and I guess it's more that kind of smarm, I suppose, that maybe Covert's going for. He's no Bill Murray, but he doesn't, you know, but you know, he doesn't need to be. But I like him here, and certainly I like him in, you know, most of his Sandler supporting roles. I'm just trying to think of like this guy, this performance, this actor leading like a more standard rom-com. I have trouble sort of picturing that. I don't know. I feel like there's limitations there to the whole Covert thing, but they found the right box for him here. Maybe that's damning with faint praise, and I don't mean to, but yeah. I can't imagine Sandler in this role, though. You're right about that.
Yeah, I mean... I feel like there's something, I mean, I guess there's something about him here. I mean, there's the people, like in terms of the comedy, like in terms of like the jokes himself, there's something, everyone else is bringing in the jokes and he's kind of the straight man here. I don't know. It's hard to imagine the movie without him, but I feel like I could potentially see a lot of different people having filled the shoes of this. Like, in a way, could it have been like a David Spade as like the lead of this? He would have maybe been a little bit too old as well, although he would have been probably like 43 to play 35. But yeah, I don't know. I mean.
Yeah, I mean, I feel like if you remove, I don't know, I feel like if you removed the, like, you're too old, like, jokes, like, I mean, like, just a couple of years later, Jonah Hill could have played, like, the lead, like, in this, like, he could have played just, like, a stoner video game designer, you know, obviously Seth Rogen a few short years later.
Rogen could have done it, yeah.
It's still a little bit of a different energy from Rogen, but... yeah, it's curious. It's because I don't think that Covert's a bad. I've certainly seen less charismatic like lead actors in like major comedies or like major movies. Like, it's not like he doesn't like, it's not like, I don't watch this movie being like, wow, this guy, I've got to see him in more movies. But like, had he continued to star in movies, I would not have said no to that. I wouldn't have been like, oh, well, like, I mean, I always thought he was, you know, when I saw that he was, that Grandma's Boy was like, he was starring in it. And I really only knew him at that point as that guy from those Adam Sandler movies. But I always thought he was funny in those movies. So it was just like, oh, like he's getting his time to shine. And I think he does. I mean, I do think he's pretty funny in this movie. I don't know. Him and Peter Dante both acquit themselves.
Yeah, Dante's killing it.
Dante, a much smaller role, but yeah.
If I can circle back to the party scene real quick, we would be remiss if we didn't comment on Linda Cardellini's powerhouse push it scene, wearing that hot as all hell green top and just fucking going for it with karaoke. I mean, again, we can, you know, kind of make jokes about slumming love interest, but you know what? She shows up and I don't know. It's fun. It's good stuff.
It's a highlight of the movie. She's totally adorkable doing karaoke.
I will say seeing her in this does make me wish that she had been cast in a Sandler movie.
Yes, agreed. I think that would be a lot of fun.
She could have played a great, like, disapproving wife to him, you know? Like, she could still, like, you know? Like, I don't know. Is she, you know, as much as I love... well, I actually don't know how old she was at this point, but it's like, as much as I love Kate, as much as I, you know, love Kate Beckinsale, just in general, it's like, oh, maybe she would have been a more believable partner for Sandler and something like Click, maybe Carly. Yeah. You could have made this swap with no problem whatsoever. She could have played the Jessica Biel part in I Now Pronounce You Chuck and Larry just a short year later. Yeah, no, she's great. And it is like, it is fun to see her here. And especially like based on the trajectory of her career. Cause yeah, like forget she's in Brokeback Mountain and that movie literally was in theaters still when Grandma's Boy opened. And yeah, and you know, she'd been Freaks and Geeks and Velma. And then, so yeah, I guess the Freaks and Geeks connection, she had she knew these, I mean, I know that Sandler wasn't on Freaks and Geeks, but the Apatow, all that whole world, there's a lot of overlap there.
Oh, for sure, yeah.
It is good to see her in one of these movies. It's a bummer she hasn't. Well, it's a bummer for us in this podcast that she hasn't done more. I'm not sure it's a bummer for her.
She's doing just fine with her Marvel checks, no doubt. Yeah. But yeah, and like
the Curse of La Llorona.
Oh yeah, God, that's right. I still haven't seen that, and at some point I want to because I'm annoyingly a Conjuring universe completist for some dumb reason. But I mean, she's leading a horror movie. I'm not going to watch it, even though everything I hear is, you know, a thumbs down for that one. She's one of those people who just like, obviously she's had a terrific career, but she never quite popped in the way you would have hoped that she would. But anyways, she's a lot of fun here.
She's been in a Best Picture winner. I mean, you got that for her.
Has she?
Green Book.
Oh God. That's right. Oh shit.
I was about to be so smug and be like, you asshole, Brokeback Mountain didn't win Best Picture. But
Ang Lee won for director, Austin, but hold your horses there, my friend. Yeah, no, shit.
That
yeah,
was you're right. Green Book came out. That was still in the future. That was still like a month or two away, that huge upset. We were probably all sitting there like, hey, it's Linda Cardellini from future Best Picture winner, Brokeback Mountain. how naive we were.
Green Book, the crash of its year. So
that's right. So she got her sweet, sweet revenge, what, like 13 years later?
Oh, Lord.
So this movie, obviously sort of contextualizing it a little bit more in the Sandler cinematic universe. We've got it's 2006, so you know, we'd already had like, you know, Happy Madison was already in full swing. This is, I believe, unless I'm missing one, this is the third Happy, the first one to release, but the third one of three Happy Madison movies to come out in 2006, because you have this, you have the Benchwarmers, and you have Click. And so the Happy Madison machine was, again, already in full swing. But a part of, you know, obviously in our earlier episodes, when we talk about like Sandler Squad, you know, a big running theme with that is that he's very loyal to his friends, and, you know, what could be more would be a better show of your loyalty than just giving your friend a whole ass movie to star in, or allowing them to make a movie on your dime, essentially, or like using your clout. And so, you know, this movie came out, and unfortunately for us and for Alan Covert's career, it did not light the world on fire. It debuted at number 13 at the box office. We were discussing this off mic earlier, but the other movies are a trip in the top 10. So it opened at number 13, but the movies that are in the top 10 are a trip. They include the first weekend of Hostel, Chronicles of Narnia, Peter Jackson's King Kong. Brokeback Mountain, in its fifth week at the box office, is five places ahead of Grandma's Boy. So, you know, we like to pat ourselves on the back about how enlightened we are now, but it seems like 2006 America, you know, American moviegoers, they were already pretty enlightened, you know, like they're choosing Brokeback Mountain over a silly bro comedy like Grandma's Boy. So the movie did not do well at all in theaters. It made $6 million on, and which, by the way, opening at number 13 and still making $6 million is like kind of like, that's a different box office landscape than what we have now. That's very different. If you open at 13 these days, I'm not sure you're making it to $6 million.
That's just a different landscape altogether when you can talk about like, oh, it only made $6 million in theaters, but then went on to probably reap a profit on home video sales and like DVD rentals and stuff like that. Like that's a different world. This would be straight to Netflix now.
Yeah. And this movie came out in, I mean, also a different world. This movie came out in January, and I looked it up earlier. It was on DVD by in May. So it's like,
oh, wow.
A bomb that took 4 months to get it onto DVD is crazy.
And I think that was probably a shortened window. Like, I think like because it was a bomb, they were probably like, well, let's just rush this shit to DVD. And like nowadays, you know, it's been 2.5 months since West Side Story came out in theaters. And I'm like, where the fuck is that movie? Come out on VOD. the movie, at least according to Wikipedia, and I don't know where they get these figures exactly. And I would be willing to, I mean, I am serenely confident in the idea that these numbers are not accurate, but they said that it had made $30 million in like from DVD sales, you know, $5 million budget. It made $6 million in theaters. So it was not a hit, but then it goes on and, you know, becomes a big, you know, college stoner sort of cult favorite, and makes 31. But I, you know, that was, I don't know when that stat was pulled, but like in 2022, 16 years later, I imagine that thing's a perennial seller for Sony. I mean, like, I don't mean like, you know, blowing the doors off, but like, I think that movie's probably comfortably like a movie that like that's never going to be a movie that like you won't find on streaming or whatever. That's not one they're going to like let lapse or be like, oh, like people are still watching this. Like, you know, something like Deuce Bigelow, European Gigolo. I don't think very many people are watching these days until we get to it in our podcast and reignite European Gigolo fever. But yeah, Grandma's Boy is, I guess what I'm trying to say is that like this movie weirdly did have like a long tail. And we're still, you know, and now I feel like it's just one of those movies that, you know, Big Brothers, the world, the country over, showed this movie to their, you know, their younger brothers, their younger kin. And we're like, yo, dude, this is the funny, you watch this, is the funniest movie you've ever seen. And I feel like a lot of people relate to it in that way. Where it's like, oh, I saw this at the right age. And it's just, you know, it's just one of the funniest movies ever because I saw it when it was one of the funniest movies ever. Right. I don't know much about the director other than he's like directed comedy specials. And the one I'm very excited to visit on this podcast, the Happy Madison horror movie that apparently exists. He directed that. So Nicholas Goosen. As we know, several of the people in this, you know, at least we had, Jonah Hill. I wonder if you asked Jonah Hill about Grandma's Boy. I wonder if he would respond. I don't think, actually, so this is out to get to that point. He didn't respond. I don't think he responded to Alan Covert's Instagram post about Grandma's Boy, wherein he tagged basically every member of the crew. But there is Brian helpfully brought to our attention earlier today. There is a follow-up of sorts to Grandma's Boy. The journey does not end with just the film. Brian, but why don't you tell us about what you found for us today?
So I was hopefully Googling for Grandma's Boy 2. Don't get your hopes up for that. But about a year ago, Alan Covert posted to Instagram an animated Grandma's Boy short with just him and Dante and Alexa, the robot who they managed to get high. It's fun. It feels like they were trying to go for a proof of concept to maybe continue on this universe.
Yeah, and I gotta say, I did find it very funny, and I just the things that Alexa was saying, like the I was made by slaves, that made me laugh. And the whole I can't feel my legs thing, and it's just like, Alexa, you don't have any legs, like, and then it turns out they're in like the whole place is like they're smoking Green Goblin because it makes you think that Willem Dafoe is there. But what I like about that, the way that's phrased, and he goes, he's like, yeah, it's called Green Goblin. It's because it makes you think Willem Dafoe's there in the room with you, but he's not. It's like that was the part that made me laugh. It's like the fact that he felt the need to add, but he's not. And then of course, later on, Willem Dafoe, you know, not actually his voice, but someone shows up, a sound alike shows up, and it's just like, Dante, your shop, your customers are here. Yeah, it's a really silly bit. Obviously it apparently like took no effort in quarantine. They were just bored. I appreciate that they did that rather than Alan Covert's other quarantine activity, which was complaining on Instagram about COVID restrictions and how dumb masks are. And it was like, please don't do this to me, man. I have a podcast. And if you just tip over too far into one direction, it's going to be very untenable for me.
Like, just keep being Alan Covert. You don't, just be Alan Covert, enjoy your millions and your good times and your sweet legacy, and don't post. Just don't post.
Please don't post unless it's more Grandma's Boy content. You know, yeah, I mean, I would love to see, it's kind of interesting. I was thinking about it because we're recording this on the weekend the day after the weekend that Uncharted, the movie, became like kind of a surprise to me, at least, speaking of video games and movies, a surprise box office hit. And, you know, I was reading all this stuff about how Sony, more so than any of the other studios, has really gone all in on theatrical exclusives. And it made me realize, now that Crackle is no longer a thing, they're sort of aborted attempt at a streaming platform. I think they jumped the gun a little bit with Crackle. I think they came out the gate a little too early. But I guess what I'm saying is Sony doesn't really have like a streaming platform to itself, like for its own movies. They like license their movies to other streaming platforms. And I bring that up because Crackle did produce Joe Dirt 2. Crackle is the reason there is a Joe Dirt 2. And so like if we're sitting here talking about like, well, in what, like how could they continue the Grandma's Boy saga? And it's like, oh, like could they take it to a streamer? And it's like, you know, I suppose they could, but it would just be like, who, you know?
How would you replace Doris Roberts as Grandma Lily?
Well, I've thought about that, Brian, and the only conclusion I can come to is digitally resurrect her from the grave in a la the end, spoiler alert, the end of the new Ghostbusters, or Carrie Fisher for certain moments in the Rise of Skywalker.
Just gonna have to get June Squibb.
June Squibb would be great.
June Squibb would be great.
I feel like I would almost want to see him in like almost like bunking at like a retirement home with them, like moving into a different place. But did they establish what happened to his, where his parents are?
No.
Okay.
Actually, yeah, no.
You know,
I guess he could have another grandma. That's your way in.
I was going to say, like, you could cast June Squibb and it wouldn't even have to be like a recasting. You could just be like, hey, other grandma. Wow, you like video games too? That's nuts. and Antiques Roadshow. Wow, it'll be just like my other grandma never left.
That's fucking crazy.
And she's just like, I'll let you stay here on one condition. I want you to call me by your other grandma's name. Wow, this will be so easy. Oh man, yeah. But yeah, no, I mean, like, you could do an animated show. You could do a streaming platform's got all this money. You know, throw something at Alan Covert while he's, you know, just get him off of Instagram. But yeah, no, it is sadly a one and done. But you know, as evidenced by his putting that short film out. Yeah, but you're right, it does feel like a proof of concept, and I guess it didn't really go anywhere beyond like whoever follows him on Instagram and like a couple of sites writing up being like, hey, grandma's boy. So yeah, kind of a bummer that this one didn't play. I Brian Connolly out there, if he hears this, will be furious at me, but I probably would have rather seen a sequel to this than a sequel to Deuce Bigalow. But but you know, it's that's all in the eye of the beholder. We don't really have the categories this time. We kind of briefly touched on all of them. You know, the slumming love interest and the product placement. You know, the Sandler squad. You know, you got Swartzen, you got Lofgren, you got Dante, you got Spade, Jonah Hill. Because Sandler isn't in this one, and Jonah Hill is just in Funny People, so it doesn't really count. But
Kevin Nealon,
of course. And then beyond that, I don't really think, unless there's like people on the periphery. I don't know if Doris Roberts ever showed up in like another Ella Sandler thing.
I don't think so. There's Dr. Shockaloo, that guy who we see later on in Blended, and That's My Boy.
He plays the same character in That's My Boy, Father Shockaloo.
So
it's all connected.
Beautiful, beautiful.
Brian, I don't know if you've had the opportunity. It's very long, so no worries if not. If you've had the opportunity to hear our the episode we recorded last, which was our recap of Sandler and all our top tens, That's My Boy placed quite highly for me.
Oh yeah, it's high up there for me too.
That's My Boy placed high, and I think for all three of us, Brian, we all included The Week Of on our top tens.
Hell yeah.
We all had Week Of in our top tens, which was very well, there was one movie that we all had in the same spot, right?
It might have been that one.
I think it was the week that we all had like it number eight.
Yeah.
So that was funny because we all like we were like doing round robin, like, okay, what do you have for year eight? What do you have for year eight? What do you know, that sort of thing. So that's Grandma's Boy. Any closing thoughts? Brian, got any closing thoughts on Grandma's Boy?
I just wanted to mention the gay robot posters in the background and touch on that and his long history with Adam Sandler, first appearing in like the early 2000s on a Don't Tell. Is that what it's called? But yeah, it was like a Nick Swartzen skit. And in 2006, they were trying to make it into a TV show, but it was only an unaired pilot. So they were really trying to make gay robot happen.
That's amazing. I did not know that. Really something that the host of a podcast like you should know, but thank you for doing that your due diligence.
Certainly.
That's funny. I did laugh every time there was a gay robot poster on screen. That was just like, I was like, gay robot seems like a great premise.
Yeah, but other than that, Grandma's Boy is one of the best stoner comedies of like the last couple decades, I would say. Like, it's right up there with Half-Baked.
Awesome. You got any closing thoughts?
You know, I was thinking about where I was on January 6th, 2021, and then I had to think about where I wasn't, and I wasn't watching the 15th anniversary of this movie because the movie came out January 6th. That's the only. I've been sitting on that one all episode. That's the only thing I think is otherwise notable in an interesting way. The films that come out on notable days, but yeah, that's all I had to say. I got nothing else. I mean, yeah, this doesn't work as much for me as y'all, which is totally fine. I'm just I think the characters in it, there's a lot of things that do work, but But yeah, I think it's, got a lot of touchstones and a lot of things that feel familiar to what we've seen in the other Sandler films. So I was glad to revisit it and kind of go through it again because it's been probably 15 years.
Mm-hmm. Almost forgot to mention the end credits rap that summarizes the entire plot of the movie. I'm a sucker for end credits raps, and that one's pretty decent.
That's a great point. End credits raps are sorely missed. Please bring those back. Yeah, Chris, did you have any concluding thoughts on Grandma's Boy?
It's, you know, it's always a pleasure to revisit this one. I mean, like I said, the last time I think I saw this was a few years ago at Vulcan, so it's been a while. And I always enjoy revisiting it. You know, there is sort of like the nostalgia glow of just good associations with buddies from, you know, from when this first came out. But now too, it's just kind of a time capsule movie in its own funny way. Just some of the 2006 signifiers, not just it being kind of in the pocket of that post-American Pie, riding the Apatow wave, Sandler kind of like wave of stuff. So there's that part of it, but also just little things too, like towards the beginning of the movie, I guess when like you're first sort of seeing the Brainasium complex, there's a song by that English band called the Futureheads who were kind of a thing for 2 months in like 2006. Like I remember they kind of had a moment when they were on one of the OC soundtracks. And then I remember like their little needle drop here in the movie. And so like that specific thing, just like, it's like a time warp back to just mid aughts, just being like, oh wow, yeah, no, like this movie is very much of that moment. But also too, just speaking to like, this was a more innocent time of, I don't want to say like an innocent time of gamer culture, but rather a more innocent time of how gamer culture was portrayed. Like, I could see a version of Grandma's Boy made today where you have sort of the same plot beats of like, you know, Arrested Development, adult gamer stoner dude gets kicked out of his place and lives with grandma. Like you can have all that stuff, but just the way that like Brainasium and the whole culture there and JP, it would be so much different now. And they probably, you know, for good reason, want to pay more lip service to how, let's say, Carlini's character would be approached. They probably just have more, you know, like female staff members, like, and all that. So just watching this, it's just, I'm not saying like, oh, the good old days before, blah, blah, blah. Like, I don't mean that at all. Just more like, oh yeah, no, this is very, like, this is a very specific time and place when gamer culture was really about to explode onto the mainstream, but it hadn't quite gotten there yet. Ditto for that matter, like the vegan restaurant scene too, where it's sort of like, oh yeah, no, like this feels very early to mid aughts, like a Family Guy bit almost, where we're just gonna make jokes about vegans, and you know, within 5 years, people would be like, okay, what is this shit? Who cares? Like, you know. So I find all that stuff kind of interesting just to revisit, but also again, it just kind of the very early college day charm for me. So I always have a soft spot for this movie. It's a fun one to revisit. And, you know, and I think just in the context of our podcast, it's just such a sweet, goofy victory lap for Happy Madison. Like, hey, let's throw all of your favorite side characters into one movie and we'll base it around weed and video games and monkeys. Have fun.
I feel like, this in response to that, I feel like a modern day update of this, or something that had been not done in that time capsule 2006, probably something between like what Silicon Valley looks like and whatever the Free Guy movie looks like. some sort of combination of those two.
Yeah, I can see that. There's something this movie like sort of like exists just like right at this like very specific time where it can be kind of guileless and innocent and sweet about, you know, and like juvenile in its way about like sort of celebrating the juvenile nature of like gamer culture in a way before that was like the toxicity of that would sort of start to ooze through the cracks in the pavement. This movie, besides watching it in college and stuff, it'd been quite a while since I'd actually like sat down and focused on it, you know, in air quotes focused.
because I was quite stoned. It's a movie that I would probably say, like, I'm somewhere between, like, I'm somewhere on the line between, like, you know, Brian and Austin on this, because I don't think, for me, especially like American stoner comedies of the past, like, you know, 25 years or so, it's like, I would put this closer to like the Half-Baked End. Like Pineapple Express is like the gold standard for me personally. And it's not like, and that it doesn't work as a movie in the way that something like Pineapple Express does, like where it's like, oh, like this is like just really made by like really, really talented people who like happen to be making a movie that's all about stoner, like about like stoners and stoner culture and all that. Although those same people also made Your Highness. It's not like they themselves are averse to going like super juvenile with it. But Grandma's Boy is a movie that just goes, especially through repetition and having seen it a bunch, the nostalgia factor, it's a movie that goes down very smoothly. And it's a movie that I find impossible to like really be mad at in any way. Like, and there's not, the movie never offended me. It was just like, it was like anytime, like if a joke didn't land, it was like, all right, moving on. Like next joke, like it wasn't like, you know, I would never begrudging the movie for, you know, not being like, you know, as funny as I wish it was sometimes, you know, as sharp as I wish it was sometimes. And the stuff that is funny is very, very funny. And I like all these, you know, I, for the most part, I like all these actors. I will say Joel David Moore's whole robot thing really grates. And I know it is supposed to grate, but at a certain point, it flies over the line between like, it's making the characters angry. And so that's my biggest pet peeve with the movie. But no, good stuff. You know, I would have seen more Alan Covert vehicles, but if this had to be his one hurrah, you know, good for him. He didn't embarrass himself. History has been, I would say, on balance, has been kind to this movie. And I think that the cult of Grandma's Boy will continue as long as there are stoner older brothers. And dorm rooms is what I would say. So I guess that's that about for Grandma's Boy. We will be. Thank you so much for listening. We will be returning soon with. I believe we are going to. We're gonna. So we started in medias res here with Grandma's Boy. We started smack dab in the middle, like with Happy Madison, already a going concern, already churning out a couple movies a year. And now we're going to take you, for our next episode, we're going to take you back. We're going to go back to some Happy Madison origins. We're going to be examining sort of the career of the lost Happy Madison member, the one who unfortunately didn't, you know, were he still with us, would absolutely be, you know, have a line of comedies produced by this studio. We're going to be covering Chris Farley. We're going to be looking at some of his early movies. TBD on which I believe we'll just do a full episode of Tommy Boy. I think that sounds right. That sounds maybe that or Black Sheep. TBD, be on the lookout for that episode to drop. But we're really excited to cover him. We'll do a few episodes on him and then we'll dive into the Schneiderverse. We'll start talking about Rob Schneider. We'll start with Deuce Bigelow, which is the proper first Happy Madison movie that was ever released under that banner. And then we'll just be off to the races and we'll be filling out the corners of this cinematic universe that we've been talking about for the better part of 3 fucking years, which is nuts. But I'm very happy to still be doing this, to continue it even past Sandler. This is great. Grandma's Boy is great. Brian, thank you so much for joining us again.
Pleasure as always. Until next time.
Yeah, absolutely.
It means a lot, Brian.
We'll have to get you back on another episode. If there are any of the, just look up Google Happy Madison, look it up on Wikipedia, and any of the non-Sandler titles, just call them. Just be like, okay, that's
will do
on that one. All right. Well, I guess that's it for us. Thank you so much for listening. As always, I am Wilson Smith.
This was Chris Giles.
And Austin Culp.
And we will see you next time on the Billy Gilmore Podcast.